We are fortunate tonight to have next in our series of Kilche talks on the connections of the Zen circle with prior Zen history and Buddhist sutras. Senior Dharma teacher Paul Julich will be presenting. So thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Jim. Hi, everybody. I'm going to be talking tonight about the Zen circle source known as the Four Realms. And the Four Realms correspond on the Zen circle with what we call the Four Worlds. So the Four Realms were articulated in as teachings in China through the Huayan school of Buddhism long ago. So you've probably heard of the Huayan Sutra. The Huayan Sutra, or the Avatamsaka Sutra, is a compendium of Buddhist teachings. You might not have heard of the Huayan school. The Huayan school refers to particular Buddhist teachings which emerged from the 6th to the 9th centuries in China. The sutra and the school are not the same thing. The teachings of the Huayan Sutra, however, served as the principal basis for the emergence of the teachings of the Huayan school of thought. So tonight I'm going to begin by talking about the Huayan Sutra, and then move into the some teachings to the Huayan school of teachings, in particular a particular treatise that was written by the first patriarch of the Huayan school, and then finally move into the Zen circle and talk about how the four realms in the Zen circle are connected. So first, the Huayan Sutra. The Huayan Sutra is probably more often referred to as the Avatamsaka Sutra. So the English renderings of the sutra name include the Flower Garland Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, and the Flower Ornament Scripture. In Chinese parlance, it's Huayan. The English translation of the Huayan Sutra was completed by Thomas Cleary. He's a scholar and translator, and it was first published in 1984. And so this is a little bit from his introduction about the sutra. The authors are unknown. It's thought to have issued from different hands in the Indian cultural sphere during the first and second centuries of the Common Era, which is 600 to 700 years after the Buddhist time. He calls it broad in spectrum and says it resists rigid systemization. So it's a compendium of teachings, and at least two of its 39 chapters are considered sutras in their own right. Translation into Chinese seems to have begun in the second century of the Common Era, and continued for almost 1,000 years. Comprehensive translations into Chinese, there are two: one made in the early 5th century, and then another in the late 7th century. And so Thomas Cleary's translation is based on the latter version, which was translated, as I said, in the 7th and 8th centuries into Chinese by a monk named Shikshananda. The text, here it is. It's 1,464 pages. And as I said, two of the chapters, that is the 10 stages and the entry into the realm of reality, which is the last chapter, I think, are said to have circulated as independent sutras in India and China. And they are also the only two sections that survive in Sanskrit. So here's a little description of the Huayan Sutra, or the Avatamsaka Sutra. This comes from Wikipedia. The Avatamsaka Sutra describes a cosmos of infinite realms upon realms, mutually containing one another. The sutra is a compilation of disparate texts on various topics such as the Bodhisattva path, the interpenetration of phenomena, the visionary powers of meditation, and the equality of all things in emptiness. And according to one scholar, the collection is characterized by overflowing visionary images, which multiply everything to infinity and describe the interpenetration of one whole and the particularized many of spirit and matter, and by the notion of gradual progress towards liberation through successive stages and an obsessive preference for images of light and radiance. It's been called holographic and psychedelic. So I want to give a taste of the text. This is a description of some of the qualities of enlightening beings who have entered the fifth of 10 stages of knowledge of the Buddhas. So this is from the chapter called The 10 Stages. And this is about the fifth of the 10 stages. They know the conventional truth from satisfying other beings according to their inclinations. They know the ultimate truth by comprehending all in one principle. They know the truth of characteristics from awareness of individual and common characteristics. They know the truth of differentiation from learning the definitions of differentiations in the teaching. They know the truth of structure from learning the definitions of the clusters, elements, and sense mediums. They know the truth of substance from realizing the pressure of the body and mind. They know the truth of becoming from continuity of realms of existence. They know the truth of knowledge of extinction and non-origination from the ultimate extinction of all burning torments. They know the truth of entry into the knowledge of the path from the accomplishment of non-duality. By accomplishment of continuity of accession to the stages of enlightening beings from perfect awareness of all their features, ultimately, they know the truth of accumulation of the knowledge of the enlightened. This is, however, on the basis of the power of knowledge in the process of application, not by ultimate exhaustive knowledge. Incidentally, a traditional approach to the sutra is to recite it aloud, either alone or with others, and I quote, bathing in its imagery, rather than attempting to gain an intellectual understanding of the material. And you can kind of see why. It's very dense, and a lot of it is like that. And this sort of language is common in the text, but it's not also esoteric. So I wanted to offer a more straightforward example from the same chapter. The enlightening beings, thus engaged in the development of sentient beings, with minds continually following Buddha knowledge, engaged in unregressing goodness, intent on the search for supreme truth, practice whatever in the world would benefit sentient beings, such as writing, teaching, mathematics, sciences of various realms or elements, medical sciences, prevention of consumption, epilepsy, and possession, warding off poison, zombies, and witchcraft, song and dance, drama, music, storytelling, and entertainment, the construction of villages, cities, parks, canals, reservoirs, ponds abounding in lotuses, groves producing flowers, fruits, and medicines, the discovery of gold, jewels, and other precious substances, methods of pointing out the signs of the sun, moon, planets, stars, constellations, movements of the earth, omens, dreams, and the characteristics of coordination of general and specific actions and forms of limbs and parts of the body, points of cultivation of discipline, meditation, mystic knowledge, the immeasurable and formless states, and whatever else is not harmful or injurious, that which is conducive to the benefit and well-being of being of all creatures, that the enlightening beings undertake, guided by compassion, to establish them in the way of Buddhas. So two contrasting sections there from the same chapter of the Huayan Sutra. So as I said, Huayan Sutra served as a principal basis for the emergence of the Huayan School. And from the Huayan School came the Four Realms. So I'm going to talk a little about some teachings from the Huayan School now. But before I do that, I want to read to you the Four Realms. I'm going to repeat them a little bit later, but I just want to just get them out there. so that they're part of the discussion now. They are as follows. The first realm, the realm of the absolute or of principle. Second, the realm of the relative or phenomena. The realm in which principle and phenomena mutually interpenetrate. So that's the third realm. And the fourth realm, the realm in which all phenomena mutually interpenetrate and do not obstruct one another. One of the principal figures in the Huayan schools was Du Xun, who wrote a treatise entitled On the Meditation of Dharma Dhatu. So the Huayan school has, there are five patriarchs identified in the Huayan schools successively. Du Xun was the first. And he wrote this treatise entitled On the Meditation of Dharma Dhatu. Another word for realm is Dharma Dhatu. So we can refer to our subject today as the four Dharma Dhatu. When you look up the four Dharma Dhatu on Wikipedia, you read this. The four Dharma Dhatu were outlined in Du Xun's treatise. Well, I've read through Du Xun's treatise, and as far as I can tell, this is not exactly true. It's probably true, but to extract them as the four Dharma Dhatu is not, wasn't particularly straightforward to me. So in the English translation that of this treatise that I have, the term Dharma Dhatu is used perhaps four times, and the first time is in the title. So nowhere does it refer to the four Dharma Dhatu. I think there are other documents that describe four Dharma Dhatu, but I could not find them. But I think in talking about this treatise, it helps us come to some perspective on the four Dharma Dhatu, that is to say the four realms. So I'm going to talk about this treatise just a little bit. It's just in the translation I have, it's just 16 pages. And I'm going to work my way into it a little bit, and then just to give you another taste of what it sounds like in translation, then highlight a few interesting points from it. And then skip over most of it, and then make a reckless leap into the four realms. Before I get into this treatise, I want to just talk terms a little bit. So in the Zen circle, we have absolute and relative. Absolute world, relative world. Du Xun talks about Li and Shi. So Li refers to the absolute, Shi refers to the relative or to phenomena. He also uses the term voidness in referring to the absolute. And you'll hear that a lot, voidness, void or voidness. Other terms that we use, substance and truth, principle and phenomena, noumena and phenomena. So these are all pointing essentially to the same things. Du Xun begins his treatise by describing three meditations. So these three meditations constitute this treatise. They are the meditation on the true voidness, meditation on the non-obstruction of Li against Shi, and the meditation on the all-embracing totality. So here is a taste of this material. This is a sample from the first meditation, the meditation on the true voidness. He wrote that this can be illustrated in four observations and 10 principles. So I'm going to present here just the first observation, the observation of reducing form into voidness, reducing form into voidness. In this observation, there are four principles. The first three principles are stated in exactly the same way, after which they're expanded with some explanation. Okay, here are the four principles of this first observation. Number one, form is not void because it is void. Here he explains that form is not void of annihilation and therefore is truly void. Number two, form is not void because it is void. Again, it's stated the same way. Here he says, form isn't exactly void. And so we say it isn't void, but form is made of nothing but voidness, and so it is void. Number three, form is not void because it is void. Here he explains that no form can be traced in voidness, and therefore it is not voidness. But form is ultimately reduced into voidness, and so it is void. And now the fourth principle. This is stated differently. Form is void. Here is what he writes about this principle. Form is void. Why? Because all forms should, on no account, be different from true voidness. Since all forms are without substance or selfhood, they are all void. If form is void, so are all other dharmas. Contemplate on this. So he instructs that a lot. He gives that instruction a lot. Contemplate on this. So what does this sound like? To me, when I was reading it and contemplating it, it sounded like philosophy, like reasoning using abstractions, like wordplay, which is to say, like thinking. And yet it is not just thinking. And I'm going to give an opinion about why in just a moment. So before we leave this treatise, I want to highlight some of the things that I saw in here that I thought were interesting. Several things here. At one point, Dushun addresses these two questions. If the absolute, or voidness, can embrace an atom with its total body, why is it not small? And conversely, if an atom, that is to say, a tiny piece of form, contains the nature of the voidness, why is it not large? So I'm not going to present his answer here. I just thought those questions were interesting. It's the approach that he takes to these kinds of questions and his anticipation of what might be questions about what he's talking about. Here's another thing from this that I selected. It's in the same section of Dushun's treatise that he makes the point that voidness has no qualities whatsoever. And to get some sense of this, we might say that voidness is like space, except that it is also void of spaceness. It is void of voidness. Because it is void of all qualities, it cannot be said to be the same as or different from anything. And this makes voidness not different, and at the same time, not same. And this reasoning seems to figure pretty prominently in Dushun's treatise in a very fundamental way, that voidness is without qualities of any kind. Referring to one of the principles that he articulates, he says something that I think is the most important instruction in the treaty, at least it was for me. So if there's any takeaway, it would be this. He says, this all-embracing principle is beyond the comprehension of the ordinary mind and is difficult to understand. It cannot be depicted properly by means of any metaphor of this world. So that's why I said a little earlier, it's not thinking. He's saying this is not about thinking or reasoning, that it can't be grasped in that way. It's difficult to understand. which is why I say it's not philosophy, it's not thinking. Now here's what he says next. But being compelled now to illustrate the subject, the following metaphor is used. The metaphor to which he's referring is one in which we might be familiar. And Thich Nhat Hanh has used this metaphor. It is the metaphor of the water and the wave. So here's what he writes about the water and the wave metaphor. The entire ocean is embodied in one wave, and yet the ocean does not shrink. A wave includes the great ocean, and yet the wave does not expand. Though the ocean simultaneously extends itself to all waves, it does not by this fact diversify itself. And though all waves simultaneously contain the great ocean, they are not one. When the great ocean embraces one wave, nothing hinders it from embracing all other waves with its whole body. When one wave includes the great ocean, all other waves also include the ocean in its entirety. There is no obstruction whatsoever between them. Contemplate on this. So again, when he's talking about the ocean and the wave, he is talking about principle and phenomena, or as we say, absolute and relative. And so, and I just want to say again that, you know, although this is a beautiful metaphor and he describes it very beautifully, as he said, it's inadequate for conveying the complete truth of what he refers to as the all-embracing principle. And one last thing, he says that in the great totality, contradiction and agreement all become harmonious with no impediment and no obstruction. So what he's saying here is that there is contradiction and there is agreement, and yet they are harmonious. This truly, to me, sounds like something that is beyond the grasp of our ordinary way of thinking. All right. Now, moving ahead to the Four Realms and the Zen Circle. So now I'm going to restate the Four Realms. The realm of the absolute or principle. We could also use the term emptiness or voidness. The realm of the relative or phenomena. So this might be things, sounds, thoughts, moods. Number three, the realm in which principle and phenomena mutually interpenetrate. And four, the realm in which all phenomena mutually interpenetrate without obstructing one another. So here, I want to connect these four realms to the Zen circle. Now the first two, the realm of the absolute and the realm of the relative. These are basic aspects of the Zen circle teaching tool, which I'm going to pick up a copy now. Eric Popsonin kindly produced this version of the Zen circle. And I'll just hold it, I'm going to hold it up for a second. First I'll talk about it. Well, no, I'll hold it up and talk about it. So on the left side is the absolute world. And this is the realm of principle. And on the right side, we have relative world, the realm of phenomena. And then down here, we have, and on the Zen circle, truth world and moment world. And truth world, well, let me go back to my notes so I don't get mixed up. In the third realm, so the first two realms are the absolute and the relative, the left hemisphere of the Zen circle and the right hemisphere. Then in the third realm, we have likely heard of interbeing. That is the where the absolute and the relative inter are and are not separate. This is in the Zen, on the Zen circle, the 360 degree point, and what we call truth world. In truth world, we understand that all things, all beings have Buddha nature. Absolute world characterizes all relative phenomena. Relative phenomena are the manifestation of the absolute. We call this our experience of truth world, big I. Next is the fourth realm, the realm in which all phenomena mutually interpenetrate. Now this realm the realm in which phenomena mutually interpenetrate seemed at first novel to me. I notice here that that in this realm, there's no mention of the absolute. It's phenomena interpenetrate and do not obstruct one another. So the floor contains the birdsong. And the birdsong contains the floor. A mote of dust contains all universes. And on the Zen circle, as I said, this is represented by moment world. But the question for me was, how? How does this fourth realm and moment world, what do they have to do with one another? What does this mean? And what does it mean for our practice? And so Eric Popesonin helped me with these questions. Going back to the third realm, truth world, we understand that we're never separate from the absolute. In moment world, the fourth realm, pardon me, we see that we are never separate from everything, never separated from everyone. We are at once us and at the same time part of everything else. We are not separate, and yet each phenomena, including ourselves, is not hindered or obstructed by anything else. It's in moment world that we find our correct function, our bodhisattva I. Moment by moment, as each situation arises, we function in a way that is helpful. When we do that, we and all other beings benefit. And importantly, I think, as we awaken, all other beings awaken as well. And when we practice Zen, we practice not just for all others, but with all others. And not only that, we benefit from the practices and helpful actions of all others. So those are the four realms and their relationship to the Zen circle. I want to share one more thing with you. This is what Dushun writes at the end of his treatise, which is again entitled On the Meditation of Dharma Dhatu. Those who practice this meditation should make an effort to bring forth the round and illuminating insight in accordance with the practice and experience of the great Huayan Dharma Dhatu without obstruction or impediment. They should contemplate this in depth until this wondrous vision comes into view. Well, that's it. I will just say that I read there's a little in the book from where I obtained the translation of his treatise. There's a little biography of him and the other patriarchs of the Huayan school, and it turns out that one of Dushun's practices was just to recite parts of the Avatamsaka Sutra and meditate upon them. Before I stop talking, I want to let you know that this, thanks to Lisa and Bob Werner, I think there's a copy of this version of the Zen Circle available through the website, and also links to a couple of articles that I thought were really great. One is from Lion's Roar, which is a publication, and I don't know if it's just online or whether they have a magazine. But anyway, it's a helpful introduction to the Avatamsaka Sutra. Very, very clear and accessible. Another one is an essay that's associated with the Minnesota Zen Center on Huayan Buddhism. And it includes a discussion of the four Dharma Dhatu. It's also very informative and fun to read. And so I would recommend both of those things for further reading. So thank you very much.
Okay, let us do time for questions, and I will do my best to call on people if you raise your hand. Let's see. Was that Sage you written? Wish I could do this as well as Tom did for our Sangha meeting. So Sage, did you have a question? No, okay. John.
I didn't have a question, but that at the end there, I'm talking about truth world being phenomena and the absolute interpenetrating, and then moment world being, you know, phenomena interpenetrating all other phenomena. I thought that was so meaningful. It's just a different view of it that I never heard before. Thank you. And great talk.
Thank you. You know, I hadn't heard of that either exactly. It stated in that way. And it was it was such a surprise. And I really had to go over it a long time and consult with Eric Pope's name as to exactly what that meant. I mean, can I say exactly? I don't know. But, you know, what I should be saying about it and how I should sort of conceive of it in a way. So it was new to me and surprising.
Something to contemplate on.
Yeah.
Sean.
I just wanted to thank you so much, Paul. You know, it's I don't know if recapitulate's the right word, but it's, you know, just experiencing your talk and I just feel like, you know, I experienced that you know, the principle and phenomena just as you're speaking, you know, and you quoting, I think it was the Avatamsaka Sutra moment, you know, you're talking about, I believe it was teachers teaching, and you're a teacher teaching, you know, it's interesting how this practice can sort of lift you up and off from, you know, the particular that we experience in this relative particular Dharma talk, and how it's, you know, universal and how far it goes. And I just felt like your talk was just a brilliant light. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Tom, you raised your hand at the same time.
It did. I was also compliments. And I was wondering, Paul, about wrapping your head around all phenomena and exist in perfect harmony and do not obstruct each other. And that's kind of like the ocean or something. You know, all phenomena seem so vast that it's not conceivable to me. And I wonder how you wrapped your head around all phenomena, not obstructing each other, and just kind of your phenomena seems like it's in some way to me something experienced, but I don't know. A philosopher could talk about phenomena, but all phenomena not obstructing one another. I was just curious how you saw that.
You know, it's a mind blower. That's why I say, you know, to go from, I think in terms of conceptually, and we're not talking about concepts here, and Eric Hopstein reminded me of that, but conceptually, it's one thing to try to imagine that we all possess Buddha nature, this absolute nature. You know, you can't quite grab onto it, and therefore it makes sense that, you know, maybe you don't quite know what it is, but it's always there, like some kind of energy or background ground of being, as it's sometimes referred. It's another thing to think about all phenomena mutually interpenetrating, and I don't know if I can think about it. Your question also reminds me about another thing from Dishun's treatise. When he talks about the absolute in a way that I hadn't. Maybe I have heard this before, probably have. But you know, that it has no qualities, and therefore, you know, and therefore it's, you know, one of the ways he argues, makes his argument is that, you know, are form and voidness the same or different? Well, he says, you know, because voidness is not different from anything, therefore it's the same as form. But actually it's not the same as form because it's also not the same as anything. To think of something that cannot be, it's beyond, really beyond conception altogether. It has nothing, including not even voidness. That was another challenging point to contemplate.
Sonsini.
A really great talk, Paul. Thank you so much for that. If you think about the format of the koans that we work with, we often encounter this phrasing that you brought out in your talk. If you say, this is a stick, you know, is this a stick or is it not a stick? Which one, are they the same or are they different? And where does it lead us? To this fourth realm, always to this fourth realm. So, you know, it's I think it's really wonderful that each of the talks that we have are digging into different texts, different historical teachers, and to where it throws us off a little bit in its terminology or context, it can also really help to awaken us in a fresh way. So thank you for demonstrating that, Paul.
Thank you.
Gerald.
Paul, thanks. There's just really two comments. I don't even know if these are questions. I remember Jibong Sansa talking about the Huayan Sutra several years ago. And he said, if you want to try to get your mind around some of it, you maybe need to go talk to a quantum physicist. And I was reminded of that, particularly when you got into the talking about atoms in what you were saying. And of course, I wonder how much, well, let me back up. So then you talked about noumena and phenomena too, and you said it was like a work of philosophy. So I went back to Plato and the theory of forms and the cave, and that sort of came up in my mind. So so where this all left me is that I thought, well, if the Diamond Sutra was maybe high school level, Huayan Sutra would be PhD graduate school because some of the language that you were using seemed to overlap, particularly in the way you're talking about the void not being void and you know, and that sort of thing. So I'm provoked a little bit in a good way by the talk. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. I want to just comment that, you know, I had a copy of the Avatamsaka Sutra and I have tried to delve into it before, starting from the beginning and reading it, you know. And, you know, it's big and it just goes on for pages and pages and pages talking about, you know, all the Buddhas that are present and Bodhisattvas and various beings that are present, you know, in this moment and what they're doing and, you know, all their different names. And so I got a little muddled and didn't continue. I am grateful for this opportunity to have to talk about that and some of this other stuff that is, you know, dates far back into our tradition, and found at the end that, you know, it is accessible, it's available, and I would just say to anyone who was curious, not to think, oh, that's too much or something, but you know, just to look into these things, into these various sources. It was very interesting to do it and worth the time.
Okay, any more questions? A few people don't have video, so if you have a question, feel free to unmute yourself and go ahead and ask it, but otherwise, we can wrap things up.
That represented a progression towards some end point, but that we may find ourselves, or we may be always be on every point of this end circle. So there's no value associated with, you know, this realm, that realm, this world, this way of being. That's one thing I would say. But yes, my interpretation is that it's not a philosophy. Yes. It's not trying to prove a point. Rather, so point to the truth, which we can experience but can't really describe.
And Pope Sinim.
Paul, wonderful talk. Thank you so much. That was really great. Meg, wonderful question, and wonderful that you noticed that. I'm going to second Paul's urging to read. I haven't read the Lion's Roar article that he has posted, but he did send me the one from the Minnesota Zen Center, and it's very clear and just really worth your time. And if I remember it correctly, one of the things they said was in the YN school, they use these four realms as methods of meditation. So they would meditate on the realm of phenomena. Then they would have another meditation practice where they meditate on the realm of the absolute, and then the realm where the absolute and the relative are inseparable, which is the truth. Truth world, because it is the truth. The relative and the absolute are never separate. And then the fourth realm, where all phenomenon is interpenetrates with, and Paul talked about without obstruction, but Sansanim, in a recent talk, talked about another translation of that, which is all phenomenon interpenetrate in perfect harmony. So I would urge you to read that. It's very clear. I know there's a lot of heavy kind of mind-blowing thinking in the sutra, in the material Paul talked about, and I thought he just did a terrific job of that. But if you don't remember anything else, two of the things that, or maybe the most important aspect of our practice in the regular world is compassion. And we talk about wisdom and compassion. And Buddhist compassion is recognizing that all phenomenon completely interpenetrate. So Buddhist compassion is very different in a sense from doing a good thing. You're doing something because you see that what we normally think of as another person or any kind of other being is in fact not separate from ourselves. Mind-blowing. You don't have to get to the quantum physics level of parsing all the details of that, but that's something that can drive you towards how you live your life. It's really important. Anyway, great talk, great question.